You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Hi, everyone. My name is Nancy Zirkin, and I'm the vice chair of the U.S. Institute of Peace Board of Directors. I would like to welcome everyone to this signature series called First in War, First in Peace. The series was established to honor, engage, and learn from those who serve in the U.S. military and the front lines in dealing with violent conflict. In our audience today, we have many members of the armed forces, both those on active duty and veterans. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for your service. Let's give them a big round of applause. I also want to point out an important video playing on the screen as you entered this event. It is a message from Representative Jason Crow of Colorado expressing his gratitude to fellow veterans for their service and critical contributions to peace building. USIP was founded in 1984 by an act of Congress to serve as an independent, nonpartisan institute devoted to the prevention, management, and resolution of conflict without recourse to violence. Today, the Institute is focusing on conflicts in 90 countries around the world. Our work involves analyzing the root causes of violent conflicts, developing strategies and options for dealing with nonviolently with conflict and helping people end and recover from conflict. Active duty military and military veterans are critical to the Institute's work. Military veterans in Congress, veterans of the Second World War, Korean War, Vietnam War led the way by passing the USIP Act that established the Institute. Veterans on our staff are working every day here at headquarters and in the field to bring peace. And veterans on our senior military advisory groups, retired general officers, help guide our work here. This event is named in honor of George Washington, one of America's first veterans. The title, First in War, First in Peace, is taken from the famous eulogy by General Henry Lee, who tried to capture the essence of George Washington after he passed away in 1799. Washington led the Continental Army to victory in 1783. He led the effort that crafted our current Constitution to create a more perfect union among the American people. And he led as the first president. In 1796, President Washington proposed the establishment of two federal institutions to strengthen and secure our democracy. One was an Academy on War, which Congress approved 6 years later, which was the Military Academy at West Point, founded in 1802. The other institution was an Academy of Peace, an idea which Congress deliberated for 17 decades. This led to the founding of the Institute of Peace in 1984. Some things take a very long time to happen. One of the senators who led the effort to establish USIP was Mark Hatfield of Oregon. Senator Hatfield commanded landing craft carrying Marines to the beaches of Iwo Jima and Okinawa during the Pacific War. As a Navy lieutenant, he led the first American team to survey the destruction after the bombing of Hiroshima in 1945. He was therefore no stranger to warfare. Senator Hatfield once commented on George Washington becoming a champion of an academy on peace. He said, and I quote, "At first it may seem to be irony that the first great military hero of our country would have asked to be remembered in such a way. This should not come as a surprise to us, however. Often those who have experienced the most brutal and devastating manifestation of warfare become some of the most eloquent spokesmen for finding ways to avoid wars in the future." End quote. Today we will hear from four people about this legacy of our military finding ways to avoid wars in the future, deal with current conflicts and end conflicts so that they don't resume later. Providing opening remarks will be Dr. Lindsay Chervinsky, who is the executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library. She is a renowned historian of the presidency, political culture, and the government. Her research can be found in publications from op-eds and podcasts and in other media. Her newest book, Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Precedents That Forged the Republic, was published just 2 months ago. After Dr. Chervinsky, we will hear from a panel with two senior military leaders, Brigadier General Maura Hennigan and Colonel Carolyn Washington, retired. Introducing and moderating this panel will be Keith Mines, a U.S. Army veteran. Keith is the current Vice President of USIP's Latin American Program. He is also the author of the book entitled Why Nation Building Matters, Political Consolidation, Building Security Forces, and Economic Development in Failed and Fragile States. Without further ado, I am going to introduce and ask Dr. Chervinsky to please come forward. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Good morning. It's delightful to see you all here, and I'm so excited to be in this building. It is actually my first time, so it is a real honor to see the beautiful space and to be speaking about this topic with you all today. My goal was, I know far less about fighting wars than most of the people either in the audience or watching online, but I thought it might be useful just to set the tone for the conversation, to talk about the critical and decisive and intentional steps that Washington took both during the Revolution and then in the immediate aftermath to try and establish the society on a peaceful footing and to ensure that the goals for which the Revolution had been fought endured. And he did three things in order to do so. So the first was he fought the war in such a way that peace would be possible afterwards. As many of you know, anytime you have an armed force that is near a civilian body, that can pose potential challenges. Even the very best behaved of soldiers sometimes come into conflict with citizens. There's a stress on resources. There are communication challenges. There are space challenges. And this was very much true during the revolution. At times, Congress actually gave Washington almost unilateral authority to seize whatever it is that he needed to seize to fight the war in its most dire moments. Washington was very reluctant to use this power. He almost never did so. And when he did ultimately, occasionally have to seize food to feed his troops from the local farmers, he insisted and ensured that they were paid, that any animals that were borrowed were returned, and that soldiers helped rebuild the fences that they had to take down to use for firewood. This was really important because he understood that it wouldn't mean anything to win independence if your fellow Americans hated you once the war was done. The second critical step was to ensure that the culture of the new nation was consistent with a small R republic. And he did so at a couple of very pivotal turning points. The most famous, of course, is the Newburgh Crisis, in which a selection of the officers in the army were considering using their military might to force Congress to pay them because they had not been paid for years. And they were thinking that maybe they would take over the reins of government, thinking that they would then be able to compensate themselves and perhaps govern in a more effective manner. I don't really blame them for this last piece because Congress was woefully inefficient and pretty terrible at everything. But when Washington was learning about this plan, naturally, he was very concerned about the concept of a military coup. And Washington was brilliant at theater. He understood the power of symbolism better than almost anyone. And he arranged to surprise the group of officers. Perhaps you have all heard this story. He pulled out the address from his pocket. He started reading it. And then he said, "I'm sorry." And he pulled out a pair of spectacles and said, "I have gone blind and gray in the service of my country." According to people there, everyone burst into tears, and they were immediately moved by this statement, and he was able to defang the threat. But then what came next was equally important. He started to decommission the army so that it would not maintain this threat, and he ensured that the officers did actually get pensions, and the soldiers were actually paid so that that resentment would not continue to fester. That was especially important when he returned his commission in December of 1783, right at the end of the war. He traveled to Annapolis to meet with Congress. Again, another moment of brilliant theatrical symbolic gestures. And in doing so, he established a new tradition. This was the age of Napoleon. This was less than 100 years after Oliver Cromwell had retained power after the English Civil War. It was unheard of for people to go home. But he won the war, and then he went home, understanding that Congress had to be in charge. Lastly, he cultivated an atmosphere and a commitment to civil service among his officers. One of the most remarkable and mind-boggling things about the new government, the new federal government that came into office in 1789, was just how many officers were actually in the government. Most of Congress had some form of military service. Almost all of the state legislatures had some form of military service. And it was an understanding that if they did not participate in the ongoing culture of governing, in the ongoing experiment of democracy, then it would not work. And this is where I think we can contrast perhaps the American Revolution with other revolutions, because we have learned that if there is not a culture of participation, if people aren't taught to cherish the institutions, the practices, if they aren't taught that they have to play a critical role, then the institutions crumble, especially when they are new and fragile. And so Washington established the model for how to do so, encouraged his fellow officers, and they picked up that example and ran with it. And the cohort of amazing public servants, especially in that first decade, was, I think, really unparalleled. So hopefully those themes, those ideas, some of the things that Washington did to start this process will be a good grounding point for this conversation today. I'm really looking forward to learning from our speakers, and I hope you will give them a warm welcome.
Well, we couldn't have a better framing than that. That was very concise and to the point, and had some things that have got me thinking about several things already. Our theme today is the legacy of George Washington, our first veteran who led the United States to victory in the war for independence, and then set the country on a stable course as the new republic found its place in the world. On a rapidly changing planet with new threats and new opportunities ever presenting themselves, our world, of course, is not that of George Washington. But as historian Richard Morris once commented, Washington was too realistic a statesman to imagine that rules of behavior appropriate for an infant republic separated by what was then a vast distance from Europe's power struggles could apply with equal force as the nation grew larger and more powerful. By mid-20th century, the revolution of science and technology and a multitude of other interests had tied the United States to all other peoples on the planet, end quote. So we're privileged today to have with us Brigadier General Mara Hennigan and Colonel Carolyn Washington, who will share with us some experiences and insights from their very diverse and very active careers in uniform and out on the topic of America's place in the world and how the U.S. military has been central to shaping it. Brigadier General Mara Hennigan is a native of Long Island, New York. She currently serves as the commanding general of the 2nd Marine, let me make sure I get this right, 2nd Marine Logistics Group, which provides sustainment of Marine forces throughout Europe, Africa, and the Middle East and North and South America. She was commissioned as a second lieutenant in 1994 after graduating from Mary Washington College. Her leadership roles have included command at the platoon and company levels, the commanding general of the Marine Wing Support Squadron, Combat Logistics Regiment 3, and most recently service as university president at Marine Corps University. She has also held significant staff roles and served in joint and coalition assignments during operations like Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom. And notably for us, she was a Commandant's Fellow here at USIP. Brigadier General Hennigan is a graduate of Marine Corps Command and Staff College and holds a master's degree in public administration from American University. Dr. Carolyn Washington retired from the U.S. Army as a colonel after a distinguished 30-year career, half as a military police commander and half as a foreign area officer. Dr. Washington holds a PhD from SUNY Buffalo and master's degrees from the Army War College and Naval Postgraduate School. She's currently the Women, Peace, and Security Manager at the Department of Homeland Security. Colonel Washington has held assignments at all levels of command and staff, much of it overseas, working on issues of stabilization and in multinational and joint settings. She was notably chief of the Southern Division at Africa Command in Stuttgart, where she worked closely with the Southern Africa Development Community. And while at AFRICOM, Colonel Washington also chaired the Women, Peace, and Security Working Group, where she developed an implementation plan for the integration of UNSCR 1325 on women, peace, and security within the organization, covering security cooperation activities, military exercises, and operations. So General Hennigan, Colonel Washington, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I wanted to dive right in with the big question, has anything worked? Americans are in a bit of a sour mood these days about interventions of any kind, and many seem to want to return to that period of the infant republic, separated from the world's challenges and threats by two large oceans. Part of the problem seems to be that they don't believe anything we've been doing in the world has borne fruit, and part of it may be that they see it as an all-or-nothing proposition. Either we invade and occupy another country, or we simply leave it alone. So is that a fair assessment, or are there places where you've seen the United States military successfully bring stability and peace to other nations in what might be called measures short of war? Brigadier General Hennigan, could you start us off?
I can. Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here today. I used to remind folks the first time I showed up at USIP, the Institute was looking at a document that would help more or less govern what we were doing in the Department of Defense. And it had an excerpt and was largely run by Dr. Condoleezza Rice. And so in the in the gall that I had, I immediately came back and said, well, I have questions about what's being said here, and if only I understood this a little better. And at the time, Paul Hughes looked at me and he said, no, those are great questions, Maura. You should continue with that. Here, let me bring you into this room. And at which point he said, Dr. Rice, Maura has some questions for you about what you wrote in that document. And as I often then told individuals who showed up later as fellows at USIP, that's just Tuesday here at the Institute of Peace. So what a great opportunity, what a distinguished crowd to be here. So a little humbling to start with, hey, how are you fixing the world and what have you done to contribute to that? So with that being said, I will now keep my comments much shorter because I know Dr. Washington also has that same kind of influence that we've seen in the world. And I would simply say, where folks oftentimes forget, it is the small places that we make the most or the largest impacts. And so, you know, in my time, in my career, I have watched Marines do some pretty amazing things. And while for some it might seem simple, but bringing water to a community in Afghanistan where they haven't had water and people are traveling miles and hours in order to get that water, that really made a difference. And so if we can influence that later generation of individuals to understand that what we have and what we bring oftentimes, working very closely with the whole of government, really does make a difference. And so, you know, in a personal experience that I had back in 2009, we had the distinct pleasure of working with our team and going to one of the organizations in town. Really, it was what they called an orphanage, but they had tons of young girls that were there who had come in from all of the villages. They weren't truly orphans in the sense that we have or how we describe it in the United States. They were individuals who had to leave their homes due to conflict, and so they brought them into the city, into Kabul at the time, and we were there to really just bring large pots so that they could cook food. And it was something so simple. But by the time we left, those were hundreds of girls that had seen really what other countries could do and really how to benefit them. And probably the most memorable experience for me personally was as I talked to a little girl and said, well, what do you want to do? Because what else do you ask a 10-year-old, what do you want to do with your life? She looked at me and didn't say anything about the war-torn country or where she was or where her family or her parents were. It was how she was going to be a veterinarian and that she was going to go to school and she was going to learn how to take care of all of the animals from her village. And so no different than what we see here in the United States and the same exact conversation that I would have with a 10-year-old in a local school here in Alexandria. So what a neat opportunity to, one, level set everything, but potentially have a positive influence on those individuals.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Colonel Washington?
I also want to say good morning, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. So first of all, I do not think this is a fair assessment. There are numerous programs that have been put into place to actually contribute to stability and peace globally. But this is an ongoing process. A good example is security cooperation. As a foreign area officer, I served as the ODC chief or Office of Defense Cooperation that it was called at that time in Bratislava, Slovakia from 2003 to 2005. And one of the great things about being in an assignment like that is for me as a military officer, it allowed me to bring numerous skill sets to bear to be able to work and help other our partner nations. For example, they were undergoing a transition in their military police from just being security forces and like rent-a-cops to having a combat role. Also, they were looking at centralized personnel systems And they were also, which was really important for me, is that they were looking at the development of an NCO Corps, including having their first appointed Command Sergeant Major. So there were numerous programs that I participated in, and I just want to highlight a couple of them. So one was working with the Defense Institute of International Legal Studies, or what we refer to as DILS. DILS is a really important program because it allows the legal professions within the military to conduct education and international engagement on important topics like human rights, international humanitarian law, and the law of armed conflict. And what is interesting about this program and a lot of other security cooperation programs is they have both in-resident courses and mobile training teams that actually came to Bratislava when I was there. So this was one important program. A second one, which I really loved, was the International Military Education and Training, or IMET. And this was an important program because it allowed a host country to send their military officers to several of our U.S. schools. This helped create a better understanding of the U.S., establish a rapport between the U.S. military and our partner nations to build alliances, future alliances, enhance interoperability and capabilities for joint operations. I hosted several of these officers when they came to the military police school, and a lot of them I would meet later in my career because they sent their best and brightest to our schools, and at some point they would end up being in higher level positions, chief of staffs, and to me this was a good opportunity to work with them and exchange, not just the U.S. imparting their knowledge, but an exchange of knowledge. And the last one that I really enjoyed too, because before I was active duty, I was in the reserves, and then I was also in the D.C. National Guard. So I appreciate the state partnership program. In the state partnership program, which we had in this case between the Slovak Republic and Indiana National Guard, we were able to do different cultural exchanges. They sent their NCOs to train NCOs in the Slovak Republic, and this was a great opportunity, too, for us to establish relationships and build capacity for working with our partner nations in the future. So those are just a few programs that I think that go a long way to making sure we have stability and global peace in the world.
Terrific, thanks. Let me follow up a little bit on that question of security assistance and see if General Hennigan has anything to add. There's a very good quote I picked up from Paul Angelo. He's the head of the Perry Center at NDU, the Perry Center for Latin America. And he notes that recent U.S. strategy is focused more on enhancing economic opportunity than bolstering local security forces. Although economic initiatives can help address joblessness and incentives of gang affiliation, for example, even more urgent is the task of giving regional police and military forces the training and resources they need to contain the far-reaching security threats that are preventing normal economic life from taking place in the first instance. So that was some great examples. Any other things that come to mind, General Hennigan, about security assistance as you've seen the partnership that we've had with local forces, both in the war zones of the past 20 years and in other places?
Yeah, undoubtedly in Afghanistan, we worked very diligently at those partnerships. And as a matter of fact, I can honestly attest, and I won't speak to all the services, I know the Marine Corps did it, we actually leveraged USIP and being able to better understand a wider field. As I often remind folks, the military has a tendency to cover a very large area. Our depth is usually where we leverage expertise from others, especially our whole of government approach. And in this instance, even more so is that recognition of bringing in those teams that would then be able to provide assistance not only to the local military, to the local military, but as well as the police, depending on the country at the time, whether it was Iraq or Afghanistan, being able to find those transition teams, as we like to call them, to allow them, one, to understand how we fight, how we again, provide security, defend and protect, while at the same time, maintaining that balance of you know, again, as it was pointed out earlier, this cannot be a coup. The military cannot take over. There is a role for each of us. And so we, again, strenuously work at that while at the same time teaching them the techniques, and we're even seeing that in Ukraine right now, where we, again, have provided education. We have provided the training that enables their forces to understand how we operate and potentially use that to leverage in conflict, more importantly, in peace.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I was thinking about my own experience. I was a mentor when I was a second lieutenant at Fort Bragg in 1982 for an officer, also second lieutenant from Burkina Faso, who went on to be the chief of the defense forces. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have you kept in touch with people that you worked with and Colonel Washington, anyone that you've seen go, because the ties that are formed are really critical. Yes. And what I found too was that you're kind of helping them buy into our system, mm-hmm. which is pretty generic. It's not imposing something that's all that foreign. It's just getting to a place of good order and discipline, and certainly of civil military relations. Mm-hmm. That's very different than what they might have come in with. Any other thoughts on that?
Sure. I have run into different individuals in some of the strangest places, whether at Bowling Air Force Base in the commissary, or whether I've gone to other places. Like when I was in Seoul, Korea, I met a gentleman who was actually a civilian, and I worked with him. He was a student when I was at Naval Postgraduate School. And I would just help him. He was from South Korea. I just helped him, you know, take notes, a simple thing like that. And he always insisted on taking me to a Chinese restaurant. There weren't any Korean restaurants. But I met him years and years ago, and he had, afterwards, and he had in South Korea working as a military police officer in a different capacity. And he had a very senior position there, and he remembered me. I didn't quite remember him initially. And then he introduced me to his family, and I was able to open some doors for our military police at that time that they weren't able to open themselves because of my relationship with this person. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, it lasts a long time. I thought also of a Brazilian officer that I recently met. He said he had flown in for one of these programs. He was at Dulles Airport, and he was in uniform walking through the hallways, and an American came up to him and just said, "I just want to thank you for your service." And mm-hmm. he said, "That I appreciate that. I'm actually a Brazilian officer." And the guy stopped and thought for a second. He said, "I guess the Brazilian Army's doing good things. I'd still like to thank you for your service." So let's go now, if we could, to the question of the whole of government. Both of you have mentioned that mm-hmm. on a certain level. So the number of people displaced from their home countries just keeps going up. I remember when I got here for the first time as a fellow in 2016, we were throwing around the number of 60 million. The one I just picked up from the UN is now 115 million people displaced in the world. It's like a world on the move, with the seven most fragile states also representing the five top sources of terrorism. One observer wrote that helping stabilize fragile states has been too much of a poorly informed, impersonal, technocratic, and conflicted process that has been dominated by reactions to events and is missing a more human approach tailored to various countries' circumstances. So this is, I think, what you referred to earlier about when you were here. Members of Congress seeking to bring some order to these operations passed the Global Fragility Act in 2020, acknowledging the impact on global stability of the countries suffering from extreme political and economic and social instability have on the world. So one of the things that the GFA insists on is taking a whole-of-government approach to helping fragile states reset. Referring to the acronym DIME, diplomatic, informational, military, and economic, as the tools for stabilization, somebody recently said to me that if you take the M out of DIME, the others don't amount to much. So as you've worked with different agencies, what were the keys to success in getting to a whole of government approach to warfighting and peace building, and where did the military tool fit? Let me start with Colonel Washington.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things, I spent time at several different embassies, and so there's always a country team where you have all these different interagency folks, and it could be U.S. AID, depending on where you are, of course, State Department, other ones. So we work together that way. But another good example that I discovered in working at Africa Command, one of the combatant commands, is that they actually embed interagency personnel. So there's representation of what we refer to as the three Ds of diplomacy, defense, and development, that is State Department, Department of Defense, and U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, respectively. So the COCOMs and AFRICOM, in this case, they do a great job in supporting this idea of partnering with our countries in Africa on this 3D approach to foster interagency efforts and to help drive out conflict and extremism in Africa in this case. So AFRICOM would bring in all these diverse interagency teams. The command has senior foreign service officers assigned in key positions from usually more than 10 government agencies and departments, including the Department of Homeland Security. And these interagency partners bring a wealth of experience. At AFRICOM, the deputy commander for civil military engagement is a position occupied by the Department of State. And there's also the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, a senior development advisor that they have for as part of their interagency staff. So a great example of international cooperation that I remember was Operation United Assistance in 2014. And this was AFRICOM's mission to combat the spread of Ebola in Western Africa, in particular in Liberia. Some 4,000 U.S. Army troops deployed. The USAID, of course, was the lead federal agency, and they coordinated this whole of government response through its Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance and Disaster Assistance Response Teams, or what they refer to as DARTs. So on August 4th, the then U.S. ambassador in Liberia declared a disaster, and the DART moved to Monrovia. So later on, when I was actually retired and living in Washington, D.C., I had the pleasure of going to Capitol Hill on the Senate side, and then former President Johnson Sirleaf of Liberia actually came and gave a presentation to thank the U.S., and in particular, U.S. Army forces and other military forces who went to support that effort. So this is a good example of a whole-of-government approach. We had the State Department, USAID, led by Combatant Command, in this case, AFRICOM.
Terrific. Thanks. Thanks. I was just at an NIH, and they have a whole display as well about the role they played. Yeah. Yeah, General Eddie?
Yeah, I think, the military is often described as a blunt instrument, and we are. It's very clear. Our orders are usually pretty succinct, and we move forward as you would anticipate. I think what we gain when we look at a whole-of-government approach, and if you don't mind, I'm also going to add our partners and allies in that as well. As we bring in our whole-of-government, we get the opportunity to learn that there are other ways to get to that end state or gain those means that we're looking for. And so with that, I think there are a lot of times where, you know, I look at my generation and that'll span about 10 or 15 years because of what we were in at the time. All of us were dealing with that whole of government approach, from our very junior military all the way through our senior ranks, because we were living it every day as we served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so we had the opportunity. You generally see that at the more senior military levels when we're more in a peacetime. So we're seeing that transition. So in order to really gain a better understanding, or more importantly, a more integrated approach, because really what the whole of government really does is it extends the military, or we extend their capabilities. And so with that, whether that be in our exercises, as was pointed out by Dr. Washington, we get the opportunity to really extend that perspective in the exercises that we do, whether that be here within the United States or outside in other countries, while at the same time learning really what we all do and how we can operate in the same environment, and really more or less what those roles and responsibilities are. We can also do that now through technology. We have war games. And so within our schools, or even within, you know, home station commands, we have the ability to actually run scenarios in which we can introduce different environments and different challenges that we might see. And we're able to have a better understanding of how and really what assets we can use in the future.
Terrific. Thanks. I wanted to turn now to the question of facing failure and then connecting policy and execution. In preparation for this discussion, I spoke with Phil Koznet, the former ambassador to Kosovo and chargé d'affaires in Turkey, who's done a great deal of this sort of thing throughout his career. We talked about how we address the failures, and of course there have been some. He suggested we need to face the failures head on and learn from them, acknowledging the limits of military power and the importance of close coordination, not only between military and civilian agencies, as we just heard, but also including policymakers and those on the ground executing policies. So along those lines, General Mattis writes in his autobiography, few among our citizenry choose to be warriors. They are our thin red line. No policymaker should ever send them into battle unless they have assessed the risks and costs and is reasonably confident of achieving a clear goal. Did either of you ever feel like you just wanted policymakers to better understand what the troops were experiencing on the ground? Any thoughts about how we better connect policy and execution? General Hennigan, can we start with you?
Absolutely. A lot there, too, which is interesting, because if you look at the number of individuals who can actually serve in the military or what we're seeing in the military, it is a very small margin, basically about 1% of the population now. And that's decreased over even my time in the military. On the flip side, as was mentioned earlier in the introduction, we have fewer and fewer veterans serving in our Congress. So that chasm of understanding grows larger and larger all the time. So how do we fix that, which is really the question? It comes back to really an education. And I've been fortunate enough in the military to be able to serve as part of that education with Congress. And so as military members from all of the services get the opportunity, we have small cadres who work with Congress, whether they be fellows that actually serve in individual offices, or we actually have teams that work on the Hill to be able to provide education to our congressional members, both on the House and Senate. That allows us to take individuals literally into the field. And you know, during our time, even in Afghanistan, we would have visits from our congressional members, but I would tell you, far more beneficial to the military outside of combat. They come and visit our commissaries. They come and visit our hospitals to better understand really where our families are engaging, while at the same time, they also understand and get briefed equally with where the military is and what we're doing. I took a group into, literally we were in Ukraine the weekend before the attack started, and then the following week we were in Poland at the embassy trying to understand what happened. And those are your congressional members trying to gain a better advantage to what's really going on in some of these countries and really how the United States needs to look at policy. But I'll offer one additional thought, and something that we readily leverage in the military is individuals, obviously political appointees that work there in the Pentagon at some of our more senior levels on the Joint Staff and really OSD, we're able to then provide military liaisons with those political appointees to provide more information, better understanding, and then more importantly, how those policies will affect the military as they go forward. So great opportunity, again, for an exchange of information, whether that be at the Hill or in some of our military institutions. So I would say, again, trying to continually work to educate. And really, we owe that not just to our congressional members. We owe that back to the country as well.
Terrific. Thanks.
Okay, so Mara kind of stole some of my thunder here, because I was going to talk about congressional delegations or CODELs who have come to the countries where I've been stationed, and most of them, except the ones coming on the Friday night, have been able to see some of the operations with our other our host nations, and this gives them an opportunity to see how we firsthand how we collaborate and work with them. So since she's talked extensively about CODELS, I'm going to segue to something that's near and dear to my heart. And it was mentioned that when I was on active duty, I worked on the implementation of United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325 on women, peace, and security, which is a landmark document passed in 2000, just celebrated 24th anniversary on October 31st, that in theory at least changed the concept of women in conflict from victims, especially of conflict-related sexual violence, to agents of change for sustainable change in the future. So one of the things that we do, the interagency, and we work on, is that we work directly. There's a Women, Peace, and Security Caucus that's bipartisan on the Hill. And so what we do in talking about our five lines of effort of our U.S. national strategy and national action plan on women, peace, and security, whether it's participation of women in different positions and different security forces, or protection of women and girls against conflict-related gender violence, or relief response and recovery, where we're providing humanitarian assistance, especially in climate-related disasters, or integration and institutionalization of our women, peace, and security principles, where we look at the different security needs of not only women and girls, but men, boys, and other genders, and how we protect them in different scenarios, even if we're looking at things like countering terrorism. And lastly, our line of effort dealing with partnerships, both internationally and domestically. So we work very closely and periodically. We go and brief the Women, Peace, and Security Caucus on the Hill to make them aware, and this is the interagency including State Department, USAID, and DOD, and then Department of Homeland Security, and we brief them and enlighten them on what's going on in the ground in terms of women in post-conflict zones, what's going on with women working in law enforcement. So that's one of the ways that we bring ground truth to our policymakers by working very closely with this Women, Peace, and Security Caucus that's bipartisan in Congress. So.
Great, thanks. Thanks. I wanted to just turn to a couple more issues here. One is the question of how, General Hannigan, I'll start with you on this, how learning and training has evolved over your career and where we are today with that. We in the State Department, we always were, I think, amazed at how much training goes on. In the military, we were kind of a show up and we'll figure this out when we get there organization. But there's just extensive training over and over again in the military. But how have you seen that evolve? You're coming from commanding one of the training institutes of the Marine Corps. How's that evolved in your career?
So I would offer, education, and I can now actually speak across all of the services because I had the opportunity to work with each of the services and in their schools. So again, coming back to, and as you mentioned, we have the opportunity and all of the agencies pretty much at large across the government fill in seats at our senior schools. And so we have the opportunity to be able to really interact, but more importantly, teach them how we think. And so, to your point, when we get on the ground, especially if we have individuals who have, and it's great because just like we see with our partners and allies, they are very proud to say, hey, I attended, you know, the Naval War College or the Army War College or the Marine Corps War College. So it again, just kind of shows that synchronization with all of our agencies and governments that we have, or the other government agencies that we have here within Washington, D.C. And as the Marine Corps University, who's just down the road, we actually gain a greater advantage because of location. So we have a tendency to have a lot of our agencies. And if not actually attending the school, and quite honestly, even during my tenure down at the university, we are then able to invite individuals to come in to be guest speakers. And so we had the president of USIP come down at the same time that we had the State Department come down and really talk to the students and really get them to understand that the rest of the piece of DIME and why it's so critical, why it's so important. And like I said, that M is really long. It's the D, the I, and the E that are really deep. And so really being able to gain that, the best part about it, and again, I'm very proud, obviously, of my university. You're able to reach out to, you know, individuals, Marines as young as the 23-year-old sergeant, or E5, and really span all the way through having colonels and general officers sitting in the audience and being able to be a part of that kind of conversation. The other side of that, and you mentioned it, and I know at least I think we share that, we also have our fellowships throughout, and all of, again, the services provide individuals to go to different agencies both here in Washington, D.C. and throughout, and whether that be educational institutions or the agencies themselves, able to, again, leverage that information, but then more or less become the future apostles as I sit and say things like, hey, have we talked to some of these other USAID, State Department, USIP, about where we're going or what we're doing, and how do we leverage that into our education? So that's a part of it. And like I said, I can't understate the idea that not only are we doing it and potentially, hopefully, showing what right looks like, our partners and allies, there are 36 countries represented at the Marine Corps University. That's universal across all of the services as well. So we again, gain those relationships that, to your point, there's many a commandant and a chief of defense that is sitting out in our partner nations that we're able to leverage and who have benefited from our schools.
Mm-hmm. Terrific, thanks. Mm-hmm. Thanks. So one final question, and that's on the issue of the future. You mentioned it a little bit earlier on recruiting. The Washington Post recently reported that last year the United States marked a half century since the advent of an all-volunteer force, but of the five services, only one, notably the Marine Corps, met its 2023 recruiting goal. It states that only about 23% of all Americans between the ages of 17 and 25 meet the Army's physical, moral, and educational standards. And more broadly, military recruiters find it more and more difficult to sell national service to the youthful citizens of a politically polarized society. Only about 9% of young people tell Defense Department surveys that they're likely to consider military service, down from 16% two decades ago. So what do you tell young people who are considering a military career? Beyond the personal incentives, which are considerable, how do you share what they'll actually be doing in the world, or about the potential role they might have in bringing peace and stability to places America cares about?
Mm-hmm. So I would encourage any young person to join the military. As a young woman, I first enlisted in the Army as a private, and the African-American community, which the military needs diversity. We need to, when we're out projecting our democracy among other nations, we need to look like what we're preaching. And so I think it's important to recruit from the different communities. And so the African-American community has often used, even as far back as my father's time, military service as a means of social mobility and inclusion. So I think you still have to, we talked about beyond personal reasons for coming in, but I think you still have to appeal to the reasons why young people want to come into the military in the first place. Gen Zers are really interesting to work with, but they care about a wide variety of issues. They care about humanitarian issues. They care about racial and gender equity. So I think for the military can provide a lot of opportunity for them to come and do the things they like. They have a lot of humanitarian values. And so because we're involved in crisis response and disaster relief, I think this is a good opportunity for them to come in and look at humanitarian assistance and some of the things that we do. Another thing is that they want real life experiences. And so the military definitely allows them to do that. I came into the military as a private in the intelligence field. I mean, I learned language. I had language training for like a whole year and then I went into some other different schools. And so, I mean, you're really proud when you're able to go to a country and communicate with them in their language on behalf of the U.S. military. So I think we still have to appeal to your younger generations in terms of what's important to them. And then when we do that, then I think it will marry with the military mission and what we need them to do. And I think it would make for a great partnership.
Thanks.
So the Marine Corps, we do really drive a hard bargain. And I will constantly echo General Smith's comments right now of you join us. And that's really where it stands. We have, and I will say of all militaries, we across the Department of Defense, we truly have a global scale impact. And you can walk in as a very, very young individual and make a difference. Mm-hmm. And that's the part that, again, every single time when we talk about change and really bringing people in to really garner that type of responsibility and to be able to drive that. And whether you stay for 3 years, and we do, we enjoy the youngest service of all the services as a Marine. You know, and I look and I remind individuals, and I get to frequently speak with, you know, our very young 19 to 20 year olds and remind them, you know, it doesn't go that far back to where you look. And I'll use one of our Medal of Honor winners, Jack Lucas. He was 14 when he joined the Marine Corps. He is 17 years old in 4 days when he crosses the beaches in Iwo Jima. And what kind of an impact that individual had and saved literally the lives of three others. And the only thought that he had at that time was it's either me or all of them. And so he took that kind of spirit and just drives that. And we drive that into the Marines every single day. And so I remind them once again, you join us and then we will show you the world. And so it's just such a great opportunity. And really, we do. We leverage that more than anything. And our message has not truly changed. And definitely in the 30 years that I have been, or I would tell you, throughout our history. So that's really where we go.
Well, that's a terrific closure. And frankly, I think it brings us right back to George Washington and his spirit. So I'd like to leave us with that thought. That was terrific. So I'd like to thank our panelists for joining us today, and if you will, join me in expressing our thanks for them.
Thank you. Thank you both.
And I would like to just again give credit to the veterans that are with us today and for the service that they have rendered and to those that gave the ultimate sacrifice especially, but also to the family members that I think often get kind of shunted aside in all of this, but they too have sacrificed on a real level to provide the service that our country needs. So I hope you'll join us now in a reception. We have a few more minutes to continue the conversation with us in this reception. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.